Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we'll be examining the history of Bill and Hillary Clinton and looking forward with the assumption that she is the Democratic presidential nominee and has a very good chance of being our next president. What would be the likely direction she will go? To understand this, our scholar in resident Richard Gale and myself have done an extensive amount of research using only that which is fully documented, a matter of historical record. It is not based upon any bias or prejudice, it's just looking at the facts. And because I'd done thousands of hours of research when he was governor, and I was very concerned at that time about what was going on in Arkansas, I have a little different perspective, possibly, than those that are in the media. I do not expect at any time during this campaign for any of the hosts on MSNBC or the Nation magazine editors or Mother Jones or any of the normal Democratic corporate interest groups to offer a legitimate challenge to her candidacy or her credibility. At the end of the day, people will make up their mind based upon whatever inspires them about a candidate. It may be their personality. It may be their message. It may be the history of that person's dedication to particular ideology. But after I share with you today what is information that is completely missing from any of the current dialogue, it may reframe your position. A person who I interviewed extensively today has shared some of the best scholarship on this topic. For 50 years, Sam Smith has been one of the nation's icons of progressive journalism and social criticism and activism in independent media. He's a Harvard graduate. He turned down jobs for the New York Times and the Washington Post. He would rather spend his time at the cutting edge of alternative news. In the mid-1960s, he founded the Capital East Gazette, which served the poor neighborhoods in the black communities of Washington, D.C., which later became a major publication against the Vietnam War and a pioneer in Washington, D.C., receiving statehood. In 1984, the publication was renamed the Progressive Review and is one of the most respected websites on progressive politics. He has covered the savings and loan scandal, the Gulf Wars, the Bush family, and most notably scandals surrounding the Clintons. His opposition to the Clintons early on led to his being ousted as vice president for the Americans for Democratic Action. He was later banned from NPR, C-SPAN, the Washington Post, and others. Later, this led him to be one of the founders of the Green Party in 1996. His articles have appeared throughout the mainstream and alternative publishing world, and he's authored several books, including Shadows of Hope, A Freethinker's Guide to the Politics in the Time of Clinton, as well as the Great American Political Repair Manual. His website is samsmitharchives.wordpress.com, and he is respected because of his fact-checking, his methodical investigative reporting. Also joining us today, and you have heard him many times in this program, is a long-term scholar and researcher who examines all the material before it is presented in our documentaries, in articles, and in books. He is one of the scholars on staff, Richard Gale. Richard also has a background in theology studies, as well as in biotechnology and work for the biotechnology industries. And when I tell you that a lot of homework, a lot of research goes into providing this information, it does. And all the information that we will present, we stand behind. In order to give you a better understanding of the hidden side of the Clintons, or ones that you simply didn't pay attention to, or you no longer think are relevant, I will share these. Let's begin in chronological order in 1974. A 27-year-old Clinton, only months out of Yale Law School, is back in Arkansas, eager to run for Congress. Roger Morris writes later, a relative unknown, he faces an imposing field of rivals in the Democratic primary and beyond. In the general election, a powerful Republican incumbent, yet as soon as he enters the race, Mr. Clinton enjoys a decisive 700% advantage in campaign funds over the nearest Democratic competitor and will spend twice as much as his well-supported GOP opponent. It begins with a quiet meeting at his mother's house in Hot Springs, around the kitchen table, as Virginia Clinton herself would describe. Avid young Bill Clinton meets with two of his most crucial early backers, Uncle Raymond G. Clinton, a prosperous local Buick dealer, and family friend and wealthy businessman, Gabe Crawford. As they talk, Mr. Crawford offers the candidate unlimited use of his private plane, and Uncle Raymond not only provides several houses around the district to serve as campaign headquarters, he'll secure a $10,000 loan to Bill Clinton from the First National Bank of Hot Springs, an amount then equal to a yearly income of many Arkansas families. Together, the money and airplane and gifts, including thousands more in secret donations, will launch Bill Clinton in the most richly financed race in the history of Arkansas politics, and ultimately on to the most richly financed political career in American history. And though he loses narrowly, his showing is so impressive, especially in his capacity to attract such money and favors, that he rises rapidly, becomes state attorney general, then governor, and eventually, with much the same backing and advantage, president of the United States. No mere businessman with a spare plane, Gabe Crawford presided over a backroom bookie operation that was one of Hot Springs' most lucrative criminal enterprises. And the inimitable Uncle Raymond, who had also played a pivotal behind-the-scenes role in keeping young Bill out of the Vietnam draft, was far more than an auto dealer. In the nationally prominent font of vice and corruption that was Hot Springs from the 1920s to the 1980s, its barely concealed casinos generated more income than Las Vegas well into the 1960s. The uncle's Buick agency and other businesses in real estate were widely thought to be facades for illegal gambling and drug money laundering and other ventures, in which Raymond was a partner. He was a minion of the organized crime overlord who controlled the American Middle South for decades, New Orleans' crime boss, Carlos Marcello, or Mafia Kingfish. Now, why do I share this? Because this is completely different than what we're led to believe was the evolution of Bill Clinton. Then we go ahead to 1976. He's elected Attorney General of Arkansas. Two Indonesian billionaires come into Arkansas, a man named Wrighty and a man named Liam Leong. They're close to Suharto. As we know, Suharto was a ruthless dictator for over 30 years. And one of them, Wrighty, is looking for an American bank to buy. And he finds Jackson Stevens, with whom he forms Stevens Finance. Stevens will broker the arrival of BCCI in this country and steer BCCI's founder, Hassan Abdi, to Burt Lance. Remember, Burt Lance and the Clintons and the Rose Law Firm. BCCI, one of the most corrupt banks in American history. These all begin to become connected. And then in 1977, Hillary Clinton joins the Rose Law Firm. Apparently because of pressure from Indonesia, Wrighty withdraws his bid to buy Lance's 30% share of the National Bank of Georgia. Instead, a BCCI frontman buys the shares, and Abdi moves to secretly take over Financial General, later First American Bank shares, later the subject of the only BCCI-connected scandal to be prosecuted in the United States. In 1978, Clinton is elected governor. The Clintons and McDougals buy land in the Ozarks for $203,000 with mostly borrowed funds. The Clintons get 50% interest with no cash down. The 203-acre plot, known as Whitewater, is 50 miles from the nearest grocery store. The Washington Post will report later that some purchasers of lots, many of them retirees, quote, put up houses or cabins, others slept in vans or tents, hoping to be able to live off the land. More than half of the purchasers will lose their plots thanks to the sleazy form of financing used. 2 months after commencing the Whitewater scam, Hillary Clinton invests $1,000 in cattle futures. Within a few days, she has a $5,000 profit. Before bailing out, she earns nearly $100,000 of her investment. Many years later, several economists will calculate that the chances of earning such returns legally were 1 in 250 million. Governor Clinton appoints Jim McDougall an economic development advisor. Bill Clinton's mother hangs out at the racetrack with mobsters and other local figures, including Dan Lassiter, who breeds racehorses in Kentucky and Florida and has a box at the track next to hers. Miss Clinton introduces Lassiter to Roger Clinton, Bill Clinton's brother. More than a few Little Rock insiders believe that this was a bad situation. Roger Clinton develops a 4-gram-a-day cocaine habit, getting his stuff from New York and the Bedelian suppliers based as one middleman will later testify under oath, quote, who his brother was. Charlene Wilson is one of his dealers. Dan Lassiter will give Roger work and loan him $8,000 to pay off a drug debt. Juanita Broderick, a volunteer in Clinton's gubernatorial campaign, will let her claim that she was attacked by Clinton and her lip almost bitten off. According to Roger Morris and Partners in Power, a young woman lawyer in Little Rock will later claim that she was accosted by Clinton this year, that means 1978, and that when she recoiled, he forced himself on her, biting and bruising her. Quote, deeply affected by the assault, the woman decided to keep it all quiet for the sake of her own hard-won career and that of her husband. When the husband later saw Clinton at the 1980 Democratic Convention, he delivered a warning. He said, if you ever approach her, I'll kill you. Not even seeing fit to deny the incident, Bill Clinton sheepishly apologized and duly promised never to bother her again. End quote. In 1979, Charlene Wilson will testify in a 1990 federal drug probe that she began selling cocaine to Roger Clinton as early as 1979. She will also tell reporters that she sold 2 grams of cocaine to Clinton's brother at the Little Rock nightclub El Bistro, then witnessed Bill Clinton consume the drug. Quote, I watched Bill Clinton lean up against a brick wall. She tells London's Telegraph Ambrose Evan Pritchards, he was so messed up that night, he slid down the wall into a garbage can and just sat there like a complete idiot. End quote. Wilson also describes gatherings at Little Rock's Coachman's Inn between 1979 and 1981, where she saw Clinton using cocaine, quote, quite avidly with friends. Drug prosecutor Gene Duffy will say that she has no doubt that Wilson was telling the truth. The Clintons and McDougals form Whitewater Development Company. 1980s. Governor Clinton appoints Webb Hubble to head a new state ethics commission. First task, weaken ethics legislation currently under consideration by exempting the governor, Clinton, from some of its more rigorous provisions. Arkansas becomes a major center for gun running, drugs, money laundering. The IRS warns other law enforcement agencies of the state's, quote, enticing climate. According to Clinton biographer Roger Morris, operatives go into banks with duffel bags filled with cash, which bank officials then distribute to tellers in sums under $10,000 so they don't have to report the transaction. Charlene Wilson, according to investigative reporter Ambrose Evans Pritchard, flies cocaine through the state and to a point in Texas. Other drugs, she and others say, are stuffed into chickens for shipping around the country. Wilson also serves as, quote, the lady with the snow at toga parties attended, she reports, by Bill Clinton. According to Wilson, quote, I lived in Little Rock, Arkansas, okay, and I work at a club called La Bistro, And I met Roger Clinton there, Governor Bill Clinton, a couple of state troopers that went with him wherever he went. Roger Clinton had come up to me, and he asked me, could I give him some coke, you know, and ask for my one-hitter, which a one-hitter is a very small silver device, okay, that you stick up into your nose, and you just squeeze it, and a snort of cocaine will go up there. And I watched Roger hand it over to Governor Clinton, and he just kind of turned around and walked off, end quote. Investor's Business Daily would later write, quote, Sally Perdue, a former Miss Arkansas and Little Rock talk show host who said she had an affair with then-Governor Clinton in 1983, told the London Sunday Telegraph that he would come over to her house with a bag full of cocaine. Quote, he had all the equipment laid out like a real pro. In the 1990s, Jennifer Flowers tells one host, quote, he smoked marijuana in my presence and offered me the opportunity to snort cocaine if I wanted. I wasn't into that. Bill clearly let me know that he did cocaine, and I knew people that knew he did cocaine. He did tell me that when he would use a substance and a substantial amount of cocaine, that his head would itch so badly that he'd become self-conscious at parties where he was doing this, because all he wanted to do while people were talking to him is stand around and scratch his head. Two Arkansas state troopers will swear under oath that they had seen Clinton, quote, under the influence of drugs when he was governor. Charlene Wilson is a bartender who ended up serving time on drug crimes and cooperating with drug investigators. She told a federal grand jury she saw Clinton and his younger brother, quote, snort cocaine together in 1979. Jack McCoy, a Democratic state representative and Clinton supporter, told the Sunday Telegraph that he could, quote, remember going into the governor's conference room once and it reeked of marijuana. And also, quote, several law enforcement officials who say they had seen and knew of Clinton's drug use. One-time apartment manager Jane Parks claims that in 1984 she could listen through the wall as Bill and Roger Clinton, in a room adjoining hers, discussed the quality of the drugs they were taking. Hillary Clinton makes $44,000 profit on a $2,000 investment in the cellular phone franchise deal that involves taking advantage of the FCC's preference for locals, minorities, and women. The franchise is almost immediately flipped to the cell giant Macau. A drug pilot brings a Cessna 210 full of cocaine into eastern Arkansas, where he is met by a pickup, a state trooper in a marked police car. Quote, he says Arkansas was a very good place to load and unload the drugs. According to his wife, security operative Jerry Parks delivers large sums of money from Mena Airport to Vince Foster at Kmart parking lot. Miss Parks discovers that this when she opens her car trunk one day and finds so much cash that she had to sit on the trunk to close it. She asks her husband, again, this is Vince Foster. No, excuse me. Her husband is Jerry Parks, whether he is dealing drugs. And he allegedly explains that Foster paid him $1,000 for each trip he took to Mena. Parks said he didn't know, quote, what they were doing. He didn't care what they were doing, didn't want to know, and he told her to forget what he had seen. As she had seen, quote, later, Evans Pritchard writes, quote, Foster was using him as a kind of operative to collect sensitive information on things and do sensitive jobs. Some of this appears to have been done on behalf of Hillary Clinton. Foster told him that Hillary wanted it done. Now, my understanding is that she wanted to know how vulnerable Bill Clinton would be in a presidential race on the question of, how shall I put it, his appetites. Hillary Clinton quietly lobbies on behalf of the Contras and against groups and individuals opposing the Contras. Dan Lassiter's parties become known around Little Rock for the availability of cocaine and women. Judy Gibbs, a model and a call girl who appeared in an interview on the record and ran a powerful house of prostitution in Arkansas with her sister, they also blackmail some of their more powerful clients. Both her family and one of Clinton's bodyguards will later link Judy Gibbs to the governor. She decides to cooperate with police in an investigation of Arkansas cocaine trafficking, but she is burned to death inside her home from a fire of undetermined origin. In 1999, according to a former Clinton bodyguard, Barry Spivey, had become something of a mystery man who insisted on meeting Paula Jones investigator Rick Lambert on a deserted road nestled deep in the Arkansas backwoods. The Jones investigator admitted he was none too comfortable with the situation. Spivey shared a story about a conversation he had with Clinton while on a flight over southeast Arkansas. The trooper noticed a blackened patch amidst the greenery below. Surprisingly, Clinton recognized it. That patch was all that was left of an estate that had burned to the ground in the mid-1980s. According to the state trooper, Clinton began reminiscing about rumors of his involvement with a woman of the house, a one-time penthouse pet. Her husband, Spivey said, was involved in a pornography ring. Clinton explained to Spivey, "You know that mansion just burned down right on top of him." Years later, Spivey remains struck by one thing, the eerie expression across Clinton's face as he spoke those words. 1980. Bill Clinton loses re-election as governor. He will win 2 years later. Larry Nichols will tell the George Putnam Show that he had met with Clinton and Jackson Stevens' brother Witt, and that Witt told Clinton that the Stevens were ready to back him for another run at the governorship, but they'd have to, quote, dry out of the white stuff. There are reports that followed this loss. Clinton ended up in the hospital for a drug overdose. Journalist R. Emmett Terrell later asked emergency room workers at the University of Arkansas Medical Center if they could confirm the incident. He didn't get a flat no from the hospital staff. One nurse said, quote, "I can't tell about that." Another said she feared for her life if she spoke of the matter. Also, there was a report, quote, "Dr. Sam Houston, a respected Little Rock physician and once a doctor for Hillary's cantankerous father, Hugh Rodham, says it is well known in Little Rock medical circles that Clinton was brought into a Little Rock hospital for emergency treatment for an apparent cocaine overdose. According to Houston, who told us he spoke to someone intimately familiar with the details of what happened that night, Clinton arrived at the hospital with an aide of a state trooper. Hillary Clinton had been notified by phone and had instructed the hospital staff that Clinton's personal physician would be arriving soon. When Miss Clinton arrived, she told both of the resident physicians on duty that night they would never practice medicine in the United States if word leaked out about Clinton's drug problem. Reportedly, she pinned one of the doctors up against the wall, both hands pressed against his shoulder, as she gave her dire warning." End quote. According to Jim McDougall's later account, he and Henry Hamilton, quote, "developed a system to pass money to Clinton, then governor of Arkansas. Quote, I considered it just another way of helping to take care of Bill. A contractor agreed to pad my monthly construction bill by $2,000. The contractor put the figure on his invoice at a cost for gravel or culvert work. After I paid the full amount, the contractor reimbursed me $2,000. I turned the money over to Henry to give to Clinton. Once, after I handed Henry his last consignment of 20 $100 bills to relay to the governor's office, he turned the bills over and over in one hand, like a magician. Henry grinned. You know, Caesar had his Brutus. Charles I had Cornwall. Clinton could profit from these examples if he crossed us." End quote. Now we go to 1981. Hillary Clinton writes Jim McDougall, quote, "If Reaganomics works at all, Whitewater could become the Western Hemisphere's Mecca." Major drug trafficker Barry Seal, under pressure from the Louisiana cops, relocates his operations to Mena, Arkansas. Seal is importing as much as 1,000 pounds of cocaine a month from Columbia, according to Arkansas law enforcement officials. He will claim to have made more than $50 million out of his operations. As an informant, Seal testified that in 1980 and 81, before moving his operation to Arkansas, he made approximately 60 trips to Central America and brought back 18,000 kilograms. In 1996, the Progressive Review will report, quote, "The London Telegraph has obtained some of the first depositions of ex-CIA contract flyer Terry Reed's suit against Clinton's ex-security chief and now high-end paid FEMA director Buddy Young. According to the Telegraph's Ambrose Evans Pritchard, quote, Larry Patterson, an Arkansas state trooper, testified under oath that there were, quote, large quantities of drugs being flown into MENA airport, large quantities of money, large quantities of guns. The subject was discussed repeatedly in Clinton's presence by state troopers working on his security detail, he alleged. Patterson said the governor, quote, had very little comment to make. He was just listening to what was being said. Roger Morris and Sally Denton made comments on the record of SEAL's legacy, including more than 2,000 newly discovered documents that now verify and qualify and quantify much of what previously had been only suspicion, conjecture, or legend. The documents confirmed that from 1981 to his brutal death in 1986, Barry SEAL carried on one of the most lucrative, extensive, and brazen operations in the history of international drug trade, and that he did it with the evident complicity, if not collusion, of elements of the U.S. government, apparently with the acquiescence of Ronald Reagan's administration, impunity from any subsequent exposure by George Bush's administration, and under the usually acute political nose of then-Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton. MENA State Police investigator Russell Welch will later describe the airport, pointing to one hangar he says is owned by a man who, quote, doesn't exist in history, back past a safe house in Baltimore in 1972. Another hangar is owned by someone who, quote, smuggled heroin through Laos back in the 70s. Another one is owned by a guy who just went bankrupt. So what will he do? Flies to Europe for more money. Welch points to half a dozen Fokker aircraft parked on an apron of the airport, noting, quote, the DEA has been tracking these planes back and forth to Colombia for a while now. Now we go to 1982. A DEA report, that's the Drug Administration, report uncovered by Ambrose Evans Pritchard, will cite an informant claiming that a key Arkansas figure and backer of Clinton, quote, smuggles cocaine from Colombia, South America, inside racehorses to Hot Springs. The London Telegraph writes, quote, Basil Abbott, a convicted drug pilot, says that he flew a Cessna 210 full of cocaine into Marianna in eastern Arkansas in the spring of 1982. The aircraft was welcomed by an Arkansas state trooper in a marked car. IRS agent William Duncan and an Arkansas State Police investigator take their evidence concerning drug trafficking in MENA to the U.S. attorney, Asha Hutchinson. They ask for 20 witnesses to be subpoenaed before the grand jury. Hutchinson chooses only three, according to reporter Merrill Leverett. Quote, the three appeared before the grand jury, but afterwards two of them also expressed surprise at how their questioning was handled. One, a secretary at Rich Mountain Aviation, had given Duncan sworn testimony about money laundering at the company, transcripts of which Duncan had provided to Hutchinson. But when the woman left the jury room, she complained that Hutchinson had asked her nothing about the crime or the sworn statements she had given to Duncan. As Duncan later testified, quote, she basically said that she was allowed to give her name, address, position, and not much else. The other angry witness was a banker who had, in Duncan's word, provided a significant amount of evidence relating to the money laundering operation. According to Duncan, he too emerged from the jury room complaining, quote, that was not allowed, I was not allowed to provide evidence that they wanted to provide to the grand jury, end quote. Roger Morris and Sally Denton state, according to the IRS criminal investigator Duncan, secretaries at the MENA airport told him that when Bobby SEAL flew to MENA, quote, there would be stacks of cash to be taken to a bank and laundered. One secretary told him that she was ordered to obtain numerous cashier's checks, each in an amount under $10,000 at various banks in MENA and surrounded communities to avoid filing the federal currency transaction reports required for all bank transactions that exceed that limit. Bank tellers then testified before a federal grand jury that in November 1982, a MENA airport employee carried a suitcase containing $70,000 into the bank. The bank officer went down and the teller lines handed out to each teller a stack of $1,000 bills and got the cashier's checks. End quote. Law enforcement sources confirmed that hundreds of thousands of dollars were laundered through the banks in just a few small banks in a very small town of MENA, and that millions more from Bobby Seale's operation were laundered elsewhere in Arkansas and the nation. Bill Clinton then wins back the governorship. Financial General changes its name to First American, and Clark Clifford is appointed chairman of the BCCI, and fronts begin acquiring controlling interests in the banks and other American financial institutions in Arkansas. Jim McDougall purchases Madison Guaranty Savings Loan. 1983, we see that the billionaires from Indonesia hires Carter former SB Small Business Administrator Director Vernon Weaver to chair the firm. The launch is accomplished with the aid of a $2 million loan guaranteed by the Small Business Administration. Weaver uses Governor Clinton as a character reference to help get the loan guaranteed. First loan goes to Little Rock Chinese restaurant owner Charlie Tree. In 1999, reported the Washington Post, Tree, who had become a controversial fundraiser for President Clinton, entered into a plea agreement with the Justice Department yesterday, winning leniency in exchange for telling all in an investigation of improper campaign contributions originating in China. State regulators warn Jim McDougall's Madison Guaranty SNL to stop making imprudent loans. Governor Clinton is also warned of the problem but takes no action. According to a later account in the Tampa Tribune, planes frying drugs in the MENA in coolers marked medical supplies are met by several people close to then-Governor Bill Clinton. Although he's under investigation for drug activities, Dan Lassiter's firm is given a piece of 14 state bond issues. Judge David Hale's Capital Management Services starts making loans to state figures. David Hale is a former Arkansas municipal judge and a former Arkansas banker. He worked with Jim McDougall on a $3 million in loans from a lending company he ran. He pled guilty and went to jail for conspiring to defraud the Small Business Administration and looting the funds from a dummy business he established. As part of his guilty plea in looting money from an insurance company, he provided the allegations for the Whitewater scandal and the testimony for its investigators. Hale testified in U.S. District Court that Governor Bill Clinton pressured him, meaning the judge, to make a fraudulent $300,000 loan, and that he was not named in the loan. And finally, at this point, before I take a break on this, 1984, Clinton backers Jack Stevens and his billionaire Indonesian backers buy a banking firm and change its name to Worthen Bank, and Wrighty's 28-year-old son, James, is president. And a lot of people associated with BCCI are involved. More on that. Madison Guaranty and McDougall hire Rose Law Firm, where Mrs. Clinton worked as a defense attorney. Mrs. Clinton's Rose Law Firm billing records on Madison Guaranty and McDougall Castle Grandy project that Hillary called IDC, Industrial Development Corporation. How much work she actually did on Madison and Castle Grandy was the subject of the missing billing records. McDougall also held a fundraiser at Madison Guaranty that paid off Clinton's campaign debt. Madison cashier checks accounted for thousands of the funds raised. Also, we have information foreshadowing future Wall Street interests in Clinton, Goldman Sachs, Payne Webber, Salomon Brothers, and Merrill Lynch all show up as financial backers of the governor. Mind you, they didn't with any other governor, only Bill Clinton. Also on the list, future kingmaker Pam Harriman. But Bill Clinton's funders include not only some of the biggest corporate names ever to show an interest in this tiny state of Arkansas, but some of the most questionable. A former U.S. attorney will later tell Roger Morris, quote, "That was the election when the mob really came into Arkansas politics. It wasn't just Bill Clinton. It went beyond our old Dixie Mafia. This was Eastern and Western Coast crime family money that noticed the possibilities just like the legitimate corporations did." Dan Lassiter buys a ski resort in New Mexico for $20 million, uses Clinton's name with permission to promote it. Later, a U.S. Customs Investigation report will note that the resort is being used for drug operations money laundering. Lassiter also flies to Belize with his aide, Patsy Thomason, to buy a 24,000-acre ranch. Among those present at the negotiations, the U.S. ambassador. The deal falls through because of the opposition of the Belize government. A private contractor for Arkansas prison systems stops selling prisoners' blood to the Canadian broker and elsewhere overseas after admitting the blood might be contaminated with the AIDS virus or hepatitis. Sales of the prisoner's blood in U.S. already is forbidden. Contaminated blood will later become a big scandal in Canada. Tens of thousands of dollars in mysterious checks begin moving through Whitewater's account at Madison's Guarantee. Investigators will later suspect that McDougal was operating a check-kiting scheme to drain money from the savings and loan. Hot Springs police record Roger Clinton during a cocaine transaction. Roger says, quote, "Got to get some of my I got to get some for my brother. He's got a nose like a vacuum cleaner," end quote. Roger's arrested while working at menial jobs for Arkansas bomb daddy Dan Lassiter. Barry Seal estimates that he has earned more than $100 million smuggling cocaine into the United States. But with the feds closing in on him, Barry Seal flies from MENA to Washington in a private Learjet to meet with two members of Vice President George Bush's drug task force. Following the meeting, Seals rolls over for the DEA, becoming an informant. He collects information on leaders of the Medellin cartel while still dealing in drugs himself. The deal would be kept secret from the investigators working in Louisiana and Arkansas. According to reporter Maria Leverett, quote, "By Barry Seal's own account, his gross income in the year and a half after he became an informant while he was based at MENA and while Asa Hutchinson was the federal prosecutor in Fort Smith, Arkansas, 82 miles away, was $750,000. Seal reported that $575,000 of that income had been derived from a single cocaine shipment, which the DEA had allowed him to keep. Pressed further, he testifies that since going to work for the DEA, he had imported 1,500 pounds of cocaine in the United States. And the informant, Barry Seal, will fly repeatedly to Colombia, Guatemala, and Panama, where he meets with leaders there, including Pablo Escobar and Carlos Letter, leaders of the cartel that at the time controlled an estimated 80% of the cocaine that came in the United States. Ronald Reagan wants to send the National Guard to Honduras to help in the war against the Sandinistas. Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis goes to the Supreme Court in a futile effort to stop it, but Clinton is happy to oblige, even sending his own security chief, Buddy Young, along to keep an eye on things. Winding up its tour, the Arkansas Guard declares large quantities of its weapons excess and leaves them behind for the Contras. Clinton's bodyguard, State Trooper L.D. Brown, applies for a CIA opening. Clinton gives him help on this application essay, including making it more Reagan-esque on the topic of the Nicaraguan war. According to Brown, he meets a CIA recruiter in Dallas, whom he later identifies as former member of Vice President George Bush's staff. And one on the recruiter's instruction, he meets with notorious drug leader and dealer Barry Seal in a Little Rock restaurant. He joins Seal in a flight to Honduras with a purported shipment of M16s and a return load of duffel bags. Brown gets $2,500 in small bills for the flight. Brown, concerned about the mission, consults with Bill Clinton, who says, quote, "Oh, you can handle it. Don't sweat it." On the second flight, Brown finds cocaine in a duffel bag, and again, he seeks Clinton's counsel. Clinton says to the Brown, quote, "Your buddy, Bush, knows about it. And the cocaine, that's Lassiter's deal." Clinton will win re-election with 64% of the vote. 1985, Roger Clinton pleads guilty to cocaine distribution, but cops a plea on more serious charges with a promise to cooperate. He will serve a very short prison term. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour, and we are sharing some insights from the historical record, facts that you will not hear, insights and information that are neither right nor left. They're simply information points. What we make of them is to our own choosing. I want to put this in perspective for a couple of reasons. First, because who more than any person in American history caused laws to be written to cause more people of color, more poor people, to go to prison on drug charges than any other person in history? Bill Clinton. Who has supported that? Hillary Clinton. And yet we're finding out that more drugs were dealt through MENA, Arkansas, by the biggest drug trafficker in American history. And all that on the record from multiple, quality sources of prosecutors, investigators, IRS agents that I haven't mentioned yet, DA agents I have not mentioned yet, state troopers, heads of state trooper association I haven't mentioned yet, special investigators I haven't mentioned yet, on the record. And yet, what I have not mentioned is a secret meeting at Ms. Harriman's house where some of the most powerful corporate Democrats, but these were corporate Democrats that she wanted to align with the pro-right conservative Democratic principles. They had to give money to get in, and then they took a careful look at who they would like to support and decided that the next person they would support would be Bill Clinton. That's a history lesson you have not heard. I'm Gary Nall. Let's now go over to our scholar in residence, Richard Gale, for perspective and additional insights and information. Nice to have you with us, Richard.
Gary, are you? Can you hear me all right?
We can hear you. Richard's on Skype. That's why we have the not quite the quality of audio.
Feedback? Okay, maybe I'll change that and make an adjustment.
Now, I'm concerned, as many are concerned, that if Hillary Clinton becomes president, she will not be in that White House alone. Bill Clinton will be there. Will all the other people associated with Clinton in their history also be back in power? Let's just take a look at Clinton's legacy on the environment, because Bill's legacy on the environment was also Hillary's, since she prided themselves, she and Bill, of working as a cooperative couple. We can only assume that if she's elected president, it will be a cooperation again. Tell us the truth about the Clinton legacy on the environment, since she will not be questioned by any of the major environmental groups with any intensity, as most are considered liberal or democratic.
Well, we can begin by looking in 1992 when Clinton ran for the presidency, and what was the status of the environment of Arkansas at that time. Even during that election, and we can even go back and look at 2000 when Gore ran, that we can see that the environmental movement and all the major environmental activists were not behind Al Gore because of Clinton's legacy while he was in the White House. They were favoring Gephardt. And when Clinton ran in 1992, he ran on the platform that the 1990s would be the decade of the environment. Of course, he had Al Gore as his running mate. But if we look at his record in Arkansas for those 12 years when he was governor, Arkansas was ranked, according to the Green Index, at the bottom of the pack. It had worst environmental policies in all the states. There was continual EPA violations of companies. Many of these corporations were clients of Hillary at the Rose Law Firm. He refused to really tackle a lot of the big polluters of Arkansas's rivers. He might have felt he could walk on water, and probably in the rivers of Arkansas you could have because of the toxic dumping. Arkansas was at the bottom of the pack when it came to working conditions. It was 45th for family policies, it was 45th for child welfare. 12 years as a governor, when he ran in 1992, he had doubled the state's debt. There was nothing in his legacy as governor that could have given any indication he would do much for the environment whatsoever. It wasn't that he was a terrible environmental president. I think it was that even though he spoke the rhetoric, most of his environmental policies didn't really go anywhere. Nothing was really done during the Clinton years concerning improving the environment. When Al Gore went to Rio de Janeiro for the big climate summit and kind of to put up the American our national stance on greenhouse gases and emissions, Clinton criticized the Rio that the other countries were being too ambitious. They were being too anti free market capitalism and too anti the large multinational corporate polluters, which is one of the reasons why the U.S. really never, under the Clintons, made any substantial constructive change in environmental policies. By 2000, when Al Gore was running, the major criticisms from environmental groups towards the Clinton administration, number one, was the greenhouse gas emissions, because nothing was really done for, regarding those. The second was local air quality controls, that he never went along with the demands of the EPA to toughen the standards for air quality. But probably the biggest, largest scandal in the during the Clinton years in the White House concerned the timber, the timber scandals. The federal, that would be the logging on federal lands, and these are all controlled by the U.S. Forest Service, and the Forest Service will spend billions of dollars, taxpayer dollars, to enable logging companies to cut down forests, and the government will sells those logs on the to the companies at only about a quarter of their actual market value, and so consequently the government during Clinton's time was like $1 billion in debt for almost giving away timber from public lands. That included the stripping of forests to allow for logging to go on, which cost about $30,000 per mile of roads that would be created through public lands. So that's pretty much his environmental legacy, which was pretty inept.
Richard, there's some additional things. The Clintons received an enormous amount of support from the largest nuclear facilities, whose corporate headquarters was out of Arkansas.
Right, that's the nuclear thing, right.
Yes. They also would be instrumental in seeing that nothing was done to limit strip mining in West Virginia and Kentucky and Tennessee, where you take the top of mountains off. There was nothing that was really done to protect the miners, the coal miners. There also was a strong anti-union move through the efforts of NAFTA and also the World Trade Organization. There were promises made that it would be bringing jobs to the United States. In point of fact, it caused over 1.2 million jobs to be lost. It was also under the Clinton administration that the Glass-Steagall Act, that had been in place for decades, was eviscerated. And that allowed the Wall Street banks to run roughshod. It was also during the Clinton administration that Larry Summers and Timothy Geithner and Robert Rubin were allowed to come in. These are Goldman Sachs alumni, and virtually control the U.S. Treasury and the closer association between the Treasury and the Federal Reserve. It was also under Clinton that one of the most important bubbles occurred, the dot-com bubble, which was not paid attention to, and nor anyone held accountable for it. It was also the Future Trading Commodities Act that was
Modernization
changed.
Act.
Modernization Act was eviscerated, and also the Securities and Exchange Commission had its teeth pulled out during that administration. So when you look at the total sum of the record, you see he puts more people in prison than any person in American history, and he also causes more people who are suffering at the low end of the economic scale and who have been getting some support through our welfare system to be taken off those welfare rolls. How many children, how many people suffer because of that? And yet the legacy of drugs in Arkansas under his watch is the largest, most concentrated of in American history for a small state in one single airport. You never had that at Kennedy Airport, nor at L.A. Airport, nor at Dallas Airport. You had it at Mena, Arkansas Airport. And the biggest drug dealer in American history, Barry Seals, was operating out of there, and it was none of this was a secret. It's one thing if someone had no information. It's something else if we have all this information. And it's all a matter of record. It's just no one is paying attention to the record, nor wants to. And finally, I haven't even mentioned all of the women who came forward and told people about their encounters with Bill Clinton. And if you add up those numbers, they dwarf Bill Cosby.
It would be hundreds.
It would be hundreds. And yet we, and rightly so, will condemn Bill Cosby for what he did. But why is a person that also is accused of rape, also of abuse, and then lying about it under oath, why is that person's character and sense of moral standing, why is that not questioned?
And actually, the first case of a rape that was filed, but although it was kind of hushed up, happened in 1969 when he was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford. And, of course, people, 95% of Rhodes Scholars actually graduate. Bill Clinton did not. He never completed his time at Oxford. People don't know. This is just kind of an important little piece because there is this mythology of Clinton having been the kind of radical anti-war hippie and Hillary as well, and a promoter of civil rights in her early career as an attorney. But in fact, there is very good evidence that has been substantiated through the National Security Archives, where Clinton did have a CIA asset while he was at Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar, reporting on anti-war activities, and also to be tracking draft dodgers. That was another one when he attended the Oslo Accord, and there are the letters that he was sending to his CIA asset that he would check in with. So that myth, from the very start, there's this kind of a mythology that built around him to kind of associate him with the boomer generation, which is very false. But the other thing, when we look at the 2008 collapse. You mentioned the repealing the Glass-Steagall Act, through the Graham-Leach-Bailey bill, and then the Commodities Future Modernization Act, which exempt credit default swaps from regulation. But the other one was the Community and Reinvestment Act of 1995, and that was when Clinton pressured the banks to begin doing all of these, alternate loans to low-income neighborhoods. So when you combine this combination of the repeal of the Glass-Steagall, the exemption of the credit defaults, and then this, the whole push of junk mortgages, that combination, that is what led to the 2008-2009 meltdown.
Yes, it did, and this is something we should keep in perspective. So, Richard, we're out of time. I thank you. We will do a part two on this because I'm only up to 1986, and I want to show all the things that were on the record that were going on that people were not aware of. By the way, in a letter to U.S. Attorney General Edward Meese, the Louisiana Attorney General wrote, quote, Barry Seals smuggled between $3 billion and $5 billion of drugs in the United States. That was through Mena, Arkansas. We also have, according to former CIA official David McMichael and Ray McGovern, who we've had on this program, that Barry Seal, former TWA pilot who had trained Nicaraguan Contra pilots in the early 80s and who is facing a long sentence for federal drug conviction in Florida, makes his way to the White House National Security Council to make the following proposition to officials there. He would fly his own plane to Colombia and take delivery of cocaine. He would then make an emergency landing in Nicaragua and make it appear that Sandinista officials were aiding him in drug trafficking. Seal made it clear that he would expect help for his legal problems. The Reagan White House jumps at the offer. Seal's plane is flown to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where it is fitted with secret cameras to enable Seal to photograph Nicaraguan officials in the act of assisting him with a box of cocaine. And on January 17th, the U.S. Attorney for the Western District drops money laundering and a narcotics conspiracy against associates of drug runner Barry Seal over the protests of investigators Russell Welch of the State Police and Bill Duncan, the Internal Revenue Service. And The operation goes as planned. The photos are delivered to the White House, and a triumphant Ronald Reagan goes on national TV to show that the Sandinistas are not only communists, but also criminals intent on addicting America's youth. And a Federal Home Loan Bank board audit describes Madison as financially reckless, rife with conflicts, and on the brink of collapse. It says the savings loans records are so poor that examiners could offer no real nature for the transactions. All this was intermixed. So here we have Ronald Reagan setting up a false flag to make it look like the Sandinistas are the real problem for drugs, when it's the Contras that are bringing drugs into the United States and cash. In return, we're giving them weapons. The Reagan administration and the governor's office and the body politic of Arkansas is completely at the heart of all this. And yet the corporate left, the liberal democratic community that supports Hillary Clinton, refused to acknowledge this is the character of the people that you're inviting back into the White House, as if there's no other alternative. There's no one else in this country capable of being an ethical, honest, moral person to help us redirect our country and its priorities. Thank you very much, Richard.
Okay, thank you, Eric.
And we also want to thank Sam Smith, one of America's greatest progressive journalists and activists, a Harvard-trained graduate, for sharing insight and research for this presentation. I'm Gary Knoll for the Progressive Radio Network.